This Week in Radio Tech is supported by Violet Microphones, handcrafted in Latvia for generations, on the web at violetusa.com, and by Axia Audio, introducing IQ, the brilliant new IP audio console from Axia, on the web at axiaaudio.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twert.
Well, hey, it's Chris Tarr.
You should see the way I have this all connected. Threw it together all at the last minute just to be here with you this evening.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up, Dad?
I have all your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
Along with Tom Ray, Chris Tobin, and Chris Tarr, we're all here. Glad you are, too.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. Hello, I'm Kirk Harnack, and very glad you could join us. It's the show where we talk about radio technology. You know, that includes a lot of stuff. That's everything from microphone diaphragms to, you know, condenser technology, FET preamps, mixing consoles, digital and analog. We talk about balanced and unbalanced circuits and how to feed the speakers. And then we go outside of the radio station to bring in remote audio, satellite audio. Sometimes we uplink audio. And we talk also about transmission, how we get the signal to the listeners, no matter what the medium is, whether it's over the internet, whether it's some kind of private point-to-point link or one to a few, or whether it's AM or FM transmitters. This is the place where we talk about it. Yeah, we're geeks. Yeah, we enjoy our work, and radio is pretty much in our blood. So this is the place to come for questions. We also occasionally delve into the world of amateur radio. I'd like to do a bit more of that. And we'd also talk a little bit about the business of broadcast engineering and how decisions made in the boardroom at radio corporations affect what we do as engineers. So welcome into the show. If you're a geek like us, this is the show for you. Joining me are from the Hudson Valley in New York. It's the inimitable Tom Ray. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Kirk. And we also talk about balanced and unbalanced people and how to feed ourselves. But anyway, I'm Vice President of Engineering of Buckley Broadcasting out of WOR in New York City, the big 50-kilowatt flamethrower. It's a wonderful place.
It is. Thanks for being with us, and thanks for all the work. Your wealth of knowledge, taking care of all kinds of high-power AM and FM and some medium and low-power, too, as the show. Also with us is an engineer from New York City as well. It's kind of a New York show tonight. Chris Tobin. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Kirk. How are you?
I'm good, and you work for CBS. Tell us what you do up there.
I'm the broadcast technologist for the CBS radio group here in New York City. My job is to find technologies that help us make more money. And keep us afloat.
All right. So that means you're probably not changing the styli and the turntables anymore. You're actually looking for ways that the engineering department can bring in some revenue.
Oh, definitely. And yeah, we do use styli, the USB turntables now.
Really? Tell me about that for a second. You know, I've been in some radio stations where they do some of these mix shows where they have, you know, the live DJs. I have absolutely no talent for that, even though I was a DJ for years. But, you know, the best thing I did was just a standard slip cue. You have a studio, a mix studio like this where they do a live dance show?
We have. Yes, we do. And that studio is using a Coffin mixer, SL1200s, the typical techniques. We have another station in the group that's doing Turntable Tuesdays, and we've been playing with the USB turntable. It actually sounds really good. It's amazing.
Which USB turntable are you using? Do you remember which one it is?
It's actually a no-name brand. I don't know it offhand. It's just literally we looked in a musician's catalog at one turntable USB audio connection. We gave it a try. It actually works pretty well.
Huh.
Yeah.
Somebody in the chat room says you can get them cheap at sweetwater.com. I'm sure there's plenty of other places. Yeah, I've seen them here and there, but I've never thought that there was likely to be any quality there. But you say they sound pretty good.
Yes, yes, yes. And Sweetwater, so, I believe, is where we did purchase it.
Turntable Tuesday, what is that?
On our number one music station we have here in town, they play songs, the popular songs they normally play during the week, from a vinyl. We actually play vinyl. Retired Tuesday.
Either of you guys ever play vinyl on the air? Where I was a disc jockey for a few. Yes, I invaded the airways and turned people off left and right. But Tom, you ever done some air shifts?
Oh, yeah. Done some air shifts in college. Of all things, they started me on the classical shift. I got thrown off of that very soon because I'm not a classical music fan. Then they stuck me on jazz. Didn't know anything about jazz either. So, but I've done some top 40 stuff. And it's, let's see, at WOR, we have one turntable that lives in the production room. And I don't think we've used it in 4 years.
Oh, my gosh. How about you, Chris? You been on the air?
Actually, I have in college, and I've done a couple of commercial gigs. And purposely done just so I can learn how the studios function and help the jocks get a better experience. But it's been fun.
Remember, back in the late 70s in the disco era, Dolly Parton issued a disco song. It was on an LP sized, and it was you played it at 45, and the vinyl was hot pink. And I don't remember both sides, but one side the song was "Baby I'm Burning," and it was a disco beat song of hers. And one evening, I was playing, disco, and like this was in 78 or 79, and I wasn't paying attention to the turntable speed control, and I was also on the phone with my girlfriend at the time, and I played the entire song at 33 1/3.
Hey, you know what I miss without having turntables?
What's
we
that?
Have Casey Kasem's American Top 40 used to show up on vinyl. You'd play it. We used to run it out of the FM studio at WDRC in Hartford. And, of course, on Sunday night, that's when the janitor came in. And we would repeatedly tell him, take the feather duster out of your pocket and stay away from the turntables. And sure as heck, you'd be up the hall, you'd go down to the production room, and you'd hear, hi, this is Casey Kasem on, as he hit the tone arm.
Oh! Jeez. Well, we didn't actually come to talk about turntables, although that would make an interesting subject to talk about. The old turntable technology, so many of us had the what was the Rusco turntables and some others that used the transmission that had the puck that would hit different sizes on the spindle to make it go to the different speeds.
And the big tone arm was made by Great Technology.
You can slip cue really nice with those puck-driven turntable platters.
And if you had the felt on the top, if you had to replace the felt every now and then. We seem to wear that felt out, but you'd put the felt on there, and you could hold the record while the turntable was spinning if you needed to. Usually they'd start it up fast enough. I remember, though, when the Technics SP series came out. Which one was the Haas? Was it the SP-10 was the one with the big motor?
SP-10 Mark II, yep.
And they would, the salesman, I heard, would demo that thing by standing on it and telling the disc jockey, push the start button.
And you go, there have been those stories. I have not done it myself, but I've heard those stories.
Yeah. Chris Tarr is joining us after all this evening. Hey, Chris, are you there?
I am there. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you great. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I had to run out to the great Intercom Milwaukee facilities here. We were having an issue with a satellite receiver, and I beat that into submission, so here I am.
Okay. Did a little Geek Jedi engineering there. And can you tell us what the problem was? Was it cockpit error, or did you actually have to do something?
No, actually, it was cockpit error. Everything was fine, again, which is great because I drove half an hour to get here just to see that. But, so it goes with the job. Everything's fine. So I quick, actually, being the Jedi that I am, you should see the way I have this all connected. I'm in the WMYX on-air studio, which is running the satellite programming right now. And I took an adapter plugged into a headphone jack into my computer to route the microphone audio to you and then have the headphones on here that I managed to cobble from one of the other studios. So I threw it together all at the last minute just to be here with you this evening.
So you're at the radio station.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm sitting in one of the on-air studios right now.
I didn't get that. I thought you had driven back home. But that's cool. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for still having me here.
Well, did you bring a laptop along or using a computer from the studio?
I have a laptop that I use for work that I keep in a backpack, and it's usually packed and ready to go. If I have to run out the door, I just grab it.
Gotcha. Well, hey, we got a couple more things we're going to be talking about. One of them is a couple topical things here I want to hit before we get to our subject of interesting remote broadcasts. A company called Vision Critical has done a survey of iPhone users, and they surveyed iPhone users in Canada and the USA and the UK. And in Canada, the number one feature that was asked about that iPhone users wanted was an FM radio tuner. Now, I think that's great news for broadcasters, but I'm a little surprised. The article here says that the reason for this, at least in Canada, why this is higher is because in Canada, the plans tend to charge tiered prices, and you pay for streaming either by the megabyte or tiered. And so if you want to stream audio on your iPhone in Canada, then it's going to cost you over time to more and more to stream. Whereas in the U.S., you tend to have plans that go, you got a couple of plans, but, you know, five gigs, maybe the main cap. And the U.K., well, I'll back up. The USA, 30% of respondents, it wasn't the top item, but 30% of respondents wanted an FM tuner in their iPhone. In Canada, it was 43%, and the U.K., it was 34%. Tom, what do you make of that?
I think that's good news for radio. It means people still want to listen, which is good news. I mean, particularly when you look at things. We picked up a new car for my wife over the weekend. I mean, the first thing she did was grabbed her iPod and plugged it into the USB port. So, we now have an application with WR streaming. I can stream it on my Android phone right to my Bluetooth in the car, so I can don't even have to be in the New York area, and I can listen to the station while I'm on the road now. But that I think that's very good news and positive for at least for FM radio. Don't know where that leaves AM, but it's positive for FM.
Somebody in the chat room says that they're on a 6 gig a month plan in Canada for their iPhone. So that 6 gig, I think if you stream audio every day for a reasonable amount of time, you're not going to exceed your 6 gig. I guess we could do a calculation. Streaming video, you're gonna exceed that at some point. Chris Tarr, you are you an iPhone user?
I was an iPhone user. Can you hear me? For all of a sudden, that
absolutely.
Went away.
Yeah,
okay,
you're there.
I am an iPhone user, or was an iPhone user. Unfortunately, with AT&T, I had to get rid of them because I kept missing calls. So I'm back to using a BlackBerry. But I do have an iPad that I use religiously.
I'm rather religious with my iPad. Have you tried the Flipboard application yet?
No, I just read about that today, actually. I haven't had a chance to try it out.
Actually, the pastor who married me and my wife tweeted me and he said, "Hey, you got to try Flipboard." So I downloaded it immediately, and apparently it's overloaded. You can't connect it to Twitter at the moment. It's overloaded. You can't connect it to Facebook at the moment. It's overloaded. So I was looking through the other. It's got some other good stories. Good, you can page through interesting stories though. Hey, Mr. Tobin, yeah, FM tuner and an iPhone. What do you think?
I look forward to it. It'd be great. I think the reason you're reading about Canada, excuse me, asking for an FM tuner is the other reason is that Pandora and the other music services are illegal with the royalty fees and the royalty contracts in Canada and parts of the UK. So that's probably what's the driving force. Other parts of the world, there are agreements that still have not been have come to fruition, and a lot of these music services on the internet are illegal. So you will see
you're right.
Probably.
Yep.
Yeah.
The article does say that. I didn't get to read that far down.
Yeah, it's in the survey, and I did some research on that. And there's a lot of areas that still don't allow the music to go. But still, it's a plus. I mean, if Apple does put a tuner in the iPhone, that'll be excellent. I look forward to it. The broadcast industry really should be pushing, NAB and folks should be really pushing to move that service along. So we'll see what happens this year.
Yeah. You know, in the USA, iPhone users said the number one thing that they want is choice of a wireless network.
Yes.
Certainly, there's been a lot of talk about Verizon picking up the iPhone after the first of the year. But I just read again where several people think that that T-Mobile will pick up the iPhone.
I got to agree with you on the network. I had the iPhone for quite a while, and actually at first, as an early adopter, I really didn't have any problems. But it got to be the point where, I don't know, 6-9 months ago, I would phone calls would go straight to voicemail. You know, I'd all of a sudden get a voicemail notification on my phone, followed by a call right away again in the case of an emergency that did ring the phone. And, you know, in my line of work and yours too, I mean, a lot of these phone calls can be urgent, transmitter calls. calls you, you know, if it's a telemetry issue or you're off the air or something, your phone has got to work every single time. And although I'm a big Mac guy, I have a MacBook and the iPad, and I love the iPhone. It's just, it's got to work. It's got to work as a phone. And it just didn't do that very well, at least, you know, recently with the network, which is why I had to move on, unfortunately.
And this isn't a show about iPhones, but you know what? It's such a popular device and so well thought out in so many ways. For us broadcasters, there are two companies right now, Tyline and Comrex, that make applications for the iPhone that lets you do remote broadcasting through the studio unit that each company makes. In the case of Tyline, I believe it's maybe the G5. I'm not sure if the Bridget will do that as well.
I think it's the Bridget G5 and the Bridge.
And then the folks at Comrex have some software as well. Now,
actually, their software also works on the HTC, which I have with Scrivener. Ah. Actually, it's pretty well.
The Verizon Android as well.
Yeah.
Now, it seems like I heard that the codec, the audio codec being used in at least one of these applications from Comrex or Tyline, or maybe from both companies, was actually not a really fancy codec. It was something fairly standard off the shelf. And then they just make their studio unit speak that same codec. I don't know if it's G722 or even if it's just G711 or G729. Do you guys know what codec you can use?
I was playing with the Comrex unit. I think it was G.722 they were using on that. We just started experimenting.
It sounded like G7, and again, maybe kind of a halfway between G722 and G711.
Yeah. Well, I think when I talked to the folks at Comrex, I believe they said G.722, but at the lowest end, or, you know, very, very bit, if you will, bit limited, because you're basically dealing with the bandwidth of the network. But yeah, it works. It's, you know, definitely doable.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't do a whole remote of the thing, but it's great for spot news coverage and, you know, a quick interview if you've got something going on. So
seems it might be very cool if these companies would end up putting something like HEAAC in there, because that can do some bit rates and down in the 20-30 kilobit range and sound reasonable, and up at, you know, 40-45 kilobits per second can sound okay for entertainment quality, better than G722 certainly at that kind of bit rate.
Well, you know, I wonder if the microphones and the phones, Kirk, are frequency limited to make them a little more efficient with the telephone algorithm, because my HTC 4 from Sprint, I actually sounds like the mic is somewhat frequency limited.
Okay. All right.
They definitely frequency limit for the vocoder. Frequency limit for the vocoder is in the phones. They have to.
Sure. Now, one of the companies, and I thought it was Tyline. I could be wrong. It's Tyline. Makes a pack that the iPhone fits into, which gives you more battery life externally, and it gives you XLR connectors for external audio. And I would imagine that audio would not necessarily be band limited going into the phone's audio circuits.
That's correct. You should be able to bypass it. I'm playing with a smartphone now. I think it's a Samsung with the Lucy software, the folks out of Germany. And it's when you use the microphone internally, it definitely sounds limited. They have an adapter cable using a multi-pin adapter cable. You plug an XLR, and the quality improves 100-fold. It's pretty cool.
Gotcha. Well, we ought to move on. We can talk about iPhones, but you know they have other shows on this network where they do. We've been talking about doing a remote broadcast with an iPhone or other technology, and I know that each of us has in the past been involved with doing some pretty crazy remote broadcasts. Chris Tobin and I were talking before the show about a recent one that you did, Chris, using a number of different technologies to get the live broadcast from a boat. A ship back to the studio where it had to go to get rebroadcast. Why don't you kind of carry us through that? Set it up for us and tell us what you did and what you learned in putting this thing together.
Okay, well, every year, the all-news station that I work with, 1010 Winds Radio, we do the July 4th Macy's Fireworks broadcast with the NBC Television Network. Every year, it's been at different locations around the New York City area, East River, Brooklyn, on the USS Intrepid Museum last year. So this year we were told that the fireworks display and the audience, everybody will be on a cruise ship. It'll be docked in Manhattan on the Hudson River. However, the ship will not arrive until July 4th. So you'll have to set up everything that morning and make sure it works for you. The ship is being built as we were planned during the planning stages in Rotterdam. It's for the Norwegian Cruise Lines. It's the largest cruise ship, I believe, in the world, called the Epic. So we're told, yeah, you'll be able to do everything you want, but the day of. As we all know, when you do remote broadcasts, you like to sort of set up a couple of days early. So the best we could do was get the phone circuits to the dock, to the video trucks that we'd be working with, and say, okay, once the ship docks, how do we get this ISDN and POTS up onto the ship? Scratching heads, the folks like, well, we can run 1,000 feet of cable, and then you can connect the other end, and hopefully it'll work. So given that choice, I decided 2 weeks prior to July 4th to investigate a wireless solution, not using cell phones, but using unlicensed 5.8 gigahertz IP radios, which we had used earlier on a proof of concept a couple of years ago. So here's what we did. Day of the broadcast, on a speaker tripod, a 2 foot square flat panel IP radio is mounted up on the deck. And then that antenna, that radio tuner was going to link up with an identical unit at the Empire State Building in one of our transmitter rooms on the 81st floor. And it's about a mile as the crow flies from the deck of the ship to the Empire State Building. Yes, it's Manhattan, and one of the most congested RF environments in the world. And we're thinking, wow, this is going to work. Maybe, maybe not. One nice thing with the IP radio, it has a built-in spectrum analyzer. So you plug in your laptop, turn on the spectrum analyzer, and you can look at the spectrum of frequencies that you have a choice to use. There's 25 of them. You run the spectrum analyzer for a couple of hours to get an idea of the density, or if you will, the congestion, if any, of the 5.8 spectrum. Very fortunate, we had about 6 channels out of the 25 that we could easily choose from, and we picked one, programmed both radios at the same frequency, and off we went. The beam width, okay, the beam width on the antenna is about that wide. It's about 2 degrees, so it's pointing 2 degrees, 3 degrees the backs. It's pencil thin.
Wow. Yeah.
Once you have the two antennas locked in, okay, you know, sort of like this is the ship, this is the Empire State Building. Once they're locked in, I was able to get 6 megabits of bandwidth between the remote location and the far end at the Empire State Building. At that point, we take an Ethernet cable, plug in the radio at the Empire State Building into our WAN, into a switch. Now we've extended our WAN over this radio link to the deck of the ship. So now I'm on my company WAN on the deck of a ship. And for those of you with security concerns, the radios do use a FIPS 140-2 AAS encryption, 256-bit, yeah. So we're totally secure.
Messrs. Sarbanes and Oxley will be very glad to hear that.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I'm throwing it out there, because I know there's a few folks in the audience going to say, wait a minute now, that's not SOX compliant. You can't be doing that. That's illegal. No, totally legal. Everything on the up and up. So at the other end, the boat side, we plug in an unmanaged switch, a little 5-port switch into the back of the IP radio, and now I have IP addresses on my company IP scope, and I'm ready to go. So we used an IP codec, a stereo codec in dual mono, and on one codec, we put the AM station, 1010 Winds All News, and we did our broadcast there. On the second codec within the units, 2 codecs, we put our FM station, music station. We had our afternoon and evening jock on board the ship. So 2 radio stations broadcasting from the deck of the ship covering the fireworks. And it was good. It worked. And I had also 4 computers at the table running internet service, 2 VoIP phones, and a spare backup codec on the link as well, just in case we wanted to feed audio to one of our other stations in the company. I could just tell them to dial the IP address, connect, and go. The ISDN line and the telco lines that we probably were talking about, 1,000-foot cable run, it did work. Barely. We did get ISDN on the deck where we're located. I did have an ISDN codec sitting in the wings in standby. Every so often we would drop the connection. We have to redial. But it did. It was there, barely. The IP link, though, solid. It was a proof of concept. Thought we'd try something different, and I think we're going to move forward looking to do some more of this the IP radio with the 5.8 gig. It saved me $800-$900 of ISDN charges, because the ISDN we got a refund on because it wouldn't stay locked. So I got Verizon to say, okay, fine, well, it wouldn't stay locked. I said, hey guys, yeah. It's not working.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They agreed.
And And that is, you know, for our audience, I work for a company, I work for Telos, and we make plenty of codecs ourselves. And there's, you know, a transition right now. People are looking at going to IP technology and away from ISDN technology. Part of that because the phone companies, the incumbent telcos in some places are not able to or wanting to deliver ISDN technology anymore. Although some telcos in some locations are happy to. In Hollywood, getting an ISDN line is still no problem. It's cheap. You can get it the next day, and you have it there for a day or two or three or a week or a year, whatever you want. But in other locations, you know, it can be a 6 or 8 week lead time and a big payment for installation and so forth. ISDN, what I was getting at is ISDN is a tariffed service. It's guaranteed. It has to work by law or else they can't charge you for it. Just right. Like your POTS phone line at your house has to work by law or they won't charge you for it. IP is completely different. It's not tariffed. It doesn't have to work. It's best effort basis. And if you're paying for, you know, 6 megabits per second or 18 megabits per second, you should get something close to that. Or you can cancel the service. But there aren't guarantees otherwise. There's just the rule of the marketplace. Interestingly, and people have different stories to tell all over the country and in different countries about how well their IP service works. I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. There, I have a choice of Comcast or now AT&T UVerse and regular DSL. And with Comcast, my speeds just keep increasing without my bill increasing. I pay for the tier of a gaming type service. It's supposed to be about 12 or 15 megs down and 2 or 3 or 4 megs up, and I get that usually or more. So what I'm getting at is, I think over time with competitive pressure, IP services do tend to get better. I know you can find horror stories all over the place, but you can also find places where, when I first moved in this house 5 years ago, the best that Comcast could give me at that time was about 6 meg down and about 0.5 meg up. And I'm not paying any more now, 4 years, 5 years later, and I'm getting quite a bit better service right now. So all that is to say that I think there's going to come a time when properly configured IP that you pay for the right class of service, it's going to be very reliable. I really believe that the world is getting better and better at this, and the infrastructure is getting better and better at this. Chris, would you agree or disagree with what I just said?
I would agree. I'm assuming it's me in New York or Chris Tarr. no, I would agree with you. And just to clarify, the reason I did what I did with the IP, I used our company WAN connection at the Empire State Building. So I actually was in control of my link from start to finish. So we had a T1 connection at Empire State Building back into our WAN, into the network. So I had 1.5 megabits of bandwidth on the deck of the ship over the IP radio.
Oh, and, tell me about...
The other reason would... Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I'm curious about at the Empire State Building. Did you have a person there aiming the antenna, keeping watch over that, or was it a set and forget sort of thing?
It was a set and forget on a tripod that I had set up the day earlier. I did a little protractor measurement and angled the antenna down where the ship was going to be located, did the math and said, okay, 2-degree beam width, this angle, I should be close. And it worked.
So the ship wasn't actually there yet when you aimed this thing?
No. No, I was, this couldn't be more of a, wow, you know, if this works, wow, this is the best, because there was nothing there. I was looking at a dock, a pier that was empty, and going, in about 48 hours, there'll be a very large ship in this position, and that's where I'm going to shoot a signal and put out a broadcast with 2 radio stations, not 1, but 2.
Hey, and now don't tell me anything secret here, but at the Empire State Building, were you in one of your transmitter rooms there? Is that how you had access to a window?
Yes. Yes, one of our transmitter rooms we have, it faces northwest, ideal location, and it worked. The only thing I did discover as part of this proof of concept, which was very good, it was a very good experiment, trust me, it worked. Everything it was supposed to do, it did, and then some. The best thing I discovered was the Mylar coating on the windows at the Empire State Building, which are used to keep the heat of the sun from getting in and making a mess of everything in the building. Because, you know, most office buildings have that for thermal control.
Yeah.
Apparently, this particular Mylar material is about resonant at 5.8 gigahertz.
Oh
no.
So, So when you transmit through the window, you need to increase the signal by 10 dB above what you normally would have factored in the link budget. So I was at minus 10 because the link budget for approximately a mile as a crow flies is what you should use. No. We moved it up to about 0 dBm just to get minus 10 on the other side of the glass.
Well, can't you call the guys at the car stereo shop who do the window tinting and have them scrape that off?
Moving forward, if we do this again, I have made arrangements to remove the Mylar on the window. So
is that on the inside or the outside?
It's on the inside.
Oh, good. Okay. So,
but it worked. No, but the best part of it, the idea behind the reason we're doing the IP remotes, or beginning to do more of them, is because we're doing multimedia. We're doing not only just the audio for the radio side, but we're doing video and audio for the websites. And we're getting a lot of feedback and a lot of response from folks who see what we're doing and they click on, they enjoy it. So we're seeing traffic. So I need to look at a multimedia approach rather than just a traditional ISDN, POTS codec, or you know, T1, depending on what we're doing. But yeah, now it's got video components. So it's operating like a TV station. You got to sort of like the TV remote now.
So what are you doing for the TV part? I guess some stations have been using a TriCaster, like the Twit Network uses. Do you just put a webcam up, or do you do something more professional?
We use a semi-pro camera. Actually, not, this one is not semi-pro. This is a Canon XL1. Feed that into a DV converter to a computer. We do it on a desktop, you know, small form factor desktop computer, and then feed that into the IP. Cannabis, I think we're using Cannabis and somebody else's converter. So just take the 1394 out, feed it in, and off we go. And we use the audio onboard audio card for feeding the audio in.
I'm fascinated by this. So Tom Ray, you live there, so you know what some of the challenges are in the area. What do you think about this setup?
I think it's pretty cool, pretty clever. I haven't had, Empire's a little farther south than Times Square is. When WRR was up in Times Square, we had a 5.8 gig link to the transmitter site up for a while. Lasted about a year and a half, and then we started getting interference. But there are other people using the same box with the same, the same set of frequencies that weren't having problems. So 6-1, half a dozen of the other. It's a little risky, but as we progress, the technology gets better to make these things work. So there's no reason not to, at the very least, try it.
Tom. I was just saying, the box that you're talking about, which I had the same link at my STL as well, I'm familiar with what you're talking about. That technology is different than the one I'm using now, the newer one. So it's actually a bit more improved OFDM spectrum. Still has issues with the interference, but with the spectrum analyzer built in, I actually, for a 24-hour period, could watch the spectrum and trace or track where the frequencies I could get away with. And it worked much better than the other box you and I have used for STLs. But the OFDM
that spectrum analyzer functions excellent. I like that. Yeah. I like that idea a lot. So
yeah, this new OFDM technology, orthogonal, was it frequency division multiplexing, actually works better when there's interference. Not too much, but when there's interference. And that's one of the reasons I went with it as well. The other unit that we use for the STL is a different type of spread spectrum that just not that robust. But it works.
Right,
not
exactly.
That robust.
It worked at the time, but I wouldn't try it with that.
OFDM is where I go, and I've seen some interesting demos and tests with the technology for video, and a few of the guys here in town. I'm actually using one. We're doing an experiment with 2 gigahertz, and we're doing a microwave lunchbox transmitter, and it's on OFDM 2.5 gig, I think it is, and you just take it, put it in the window ledge. Put video into it, audio, and it appears on one of the microwave receivers in town, and it's full quieting video, full screen, you know, full bandwidth. It works like a champ. It's a 5-watt unit. You put it in the window, and off you go.
No kidding. It's cool. That's very cool.
Oh, yeah.
Chris Tobin, you said you had about 6 megabits per second, but I think you said you also had a T1 at the transmitter side, so you end up being limited to 1.5 megabits per second. How did you know you had 6 megs on the IP link?
The IP radios, you can do up to 54 megabits a second. You can select it. Now, the more bandwidth you select, now remember, it's spreading the carriers out across the spectrum it's working in, so your energy is going to go down. So since I'm just doing the audio, and I did the math, the amount of bandwidth I really needed was less than a T1's worth. So yeah. I just did the math. So I'm going to do 6 megabits, get a nice robust carrier, a lot of high energy, and then just make that my link. The other end was 1.5 megabits. It was more than sufficient. It did the job. But the radios do a lot. You can set them up for the various bandwidths, the power levels, the types of packets you want to pass through. I mean, everything about it. It's pretty cool technology. It's mature. It's a mature product. It's not something that's, this is not, Black Art or Skunk Works. This is stuff that's been out on the market for several years. It's used by the military a lot for linking remote sites. And it's used by, I believe, the power field, the energy folks. They use it for linking up substations.
If Hedy Lamarr only knew what she started when she figured out spread spectrum and gave it to the military.
Hey, now
you were using codecs on this. So you're putting coded audio at a reduced bitrate across this link. And the company I work for, Telos Omnia Axio, there are some customers using Axio who actually use a spread spectrum IP radio between studio and transmitter site. And they are putting uncompressed linear audio across such a link. They would be using the live wire standard streams, which are about 2.5 megabits per second per stream. But this ends up giving you an uncompressed audio, linear quality, 24 bits bit depth and 48 kilohertz sampling, and a delay. Instead of having the coding delay, you end up having a very low delay, just a few milliseconds or a few tens of milliseconds with a standard stream on Axia. So I think that's kind of interesting too. I'd be curious. There are a number of people using Axia who do that on a permanent setup between studio and transmitter or between two studios when they have line of sight. And they're, by the way, they have to use a really high quality IP radio, the kind that start at about $10,000 for the pair of radios and go up from there, because they have to have a really strong data engine. And they have to turn off all the error correction, because when you're using an unbuffered audio stream, we ain't got no time for no error correction, if you know what I mean. There's no chance to resend a packet. I'd be curious though to see if anybody would do a remote using live IP audio, uncompressed and unbuffered, using IP radios. I think that would be pretty interesting to see that. The quality would just be amazing. 20 kilohertz, 138 dB dynamic range. So just really fantastic audio on a live remote.
Then we can smash it with our audio processing and just flatten it out and reduce the bandwidth and all those cool things to it. That's a great plan.
Now, Chris, there's other reasons we do processing. You and your program director may disagree about it, but there's other reasons we do processing.
It comes out with all this bit depth and all this frequency response, and then we just turn it into a square wave.
Yeah, but if you're going to process hard, you got to start clean, right?
That's a good point.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to squash the heck out of it, no matter what you're using, an Orban, an Omnia, Vorsys, or anything like that, if you start clean, you can do more to it and have less deleterious effects than if you start with something dirty. And if you put cell phone calls on the air, then I'm telling the truth.
Oh, yeah. No, I get you. I get you 100%. I absolutely get that. I don't know, though, that I could find a lot of applications where I need that much quality. Because I think you do risk, as you said, you kind of risk the whole inability to retransmit lost packets and things like that. The situation where you're doing a live broadcast, generally you're not, unless you're doing music, which is, I guess, not uncommon, you can still get away with, a fairly high bitrate AAC codec.
Yeah.
And be okay. And you get a little more protection that way. I do. The geek part of me, though, really does, the live wire audio just sounds really cool, though, from the geek perspective, at least.
Yeah, 48 kilohertz sampling, 48 bit bit depth. Sure. And then there's other systems to do that too. I mean, if you had a TDM router in a radio station with a proprietary TDM routing technology, you got the same kind of quality. But to be able to do that over IP is kind of interesting. Tom Ray, let's talk to you for a minute. You had a remote broadcast in particular you wanted to tell us about, where you maybe learned some lessons and found out some cool things.
Well, actually, we this must have been, 3-4 years ago. We had a client who, they have party yachts. Basically, these things are big floating ballrooms. If you want to have a have a wedding and you're looking for something unique to do, you put it on one of these boats. Hmm. So they got a brand new yacht and they wanted to do something special. So we took 320, 330 listeners with the morning show on a cruise down the Hudson River from Midtown to the Statue of Liberty and back again on the air.
Oh, wow. How'd that, and you were on the air the whole time?
Oh, we were on the air the whole time. The now some people would say, "Well, that's easy. I'll just take a MARTI unit and throw it on, you know, an RPU, a 450 yeah. link." You don't do that in New York City because they're not usable. There's just too much interference, too much noise. So,
Where's the interference from? From unlicensed users or what? I mean, there's a little tiny bit of spectrum that broadcasters are supposed to have.
You just that little tiny bit of spectrum, when you spread it amongst all the stations in town, and the fact that the FCC allows two-way radios for like television stations in the radio RPU band.
Oh.
And also you got places like Four Times Square, the Empire State Building, and several other buildings where you have receivers, which are very high-density RF. I mean, it becomes really unusable. So that's not how we did it.
Okay.
We
didn't stretch a long wire for ISDN out to the boat, did you?
Well, you know, we were considering doing that, but Verizon frowns on that. So,
so you ordered wireless ISDN from Verizon.
Oh, yeah, it would have taken like half a century to get. But
all right, I'll quit interrupting. What did you do? How'd you get good quality audio off of that boat?
We got an Inmarsat radio, which is a basically satellite telephone, but it's ISDN over a satellite link. And what Inmarsat is, there are four or five Inmarsat satellites up there that cover the entire globe. They circle the equator. And you get this radio. It's got an antenna that's kind of like this. It's flat.
Yeah.
And you set the thing up, and we took it for a test cruise. And we found that the beam width of those antennas is about 20 degrees. Before you're off the berth. So we set the thing up. We were at dock. We set the thing up. And what I did was I got a Lazy Susan turntable.
Okay.
You know, like you'd put a cake on or something. I put the antenna on the Lazy Susan. And this was on the top deck. And we had two-way radios. I had somebody, I believe it was my son, was downstairs with the broadcast crew, and he was just standing there with them, and I sat there and with a pair of headphones and the ISDN codec. We just ran audio upstairs. We dropped the cable down, and I sat there and just kind of watched the signal meter, and as we cruised down the river, just rotated the antenna ever so slightly just to keep a peek. The only time I had an issue was when believe it or not, the Hudson River in the morning is almost as busy as the George Washington Bridge with ferry traffic and everything else that's on the river. We had a boat go speeding by in front of us, and we hit the wave, and I jumped and lost control of the turntable, and we had a quick pfft on the air, but recovered and it was fine. The funniest thing about this whole broadcast, and keep in mind, this was a 4-hour broadcast. We did the whole thing on the boat.
It wasn't breaks with it. And now we'll go back to the boat for this announcement.
No. This was the entire morning show. We had all four members of the morning show there. The only thing we didn't have with us were the commercial breaks.
Okay.
The commercials were played back at the station. Gotcha. And of course, this is a bi-directional link.
42, 48 minutes per hour was from the boat.
Oh, exactly. And, you know, we did it with an ISDN codec. You know, because as far as the ISDN codec was concerned, we were looking at an ISDN line. Mm-hmm. It's not cheap to do it because Inmarsat is an international call, and if I'm not mistaken, the calls were routed through France, so we were talking $2 a minute for a 4-hour show. But the funniest thing, you know, the idea was to christen this boat. So we had the thing set up, and they got we have a woman who does the midday show. Her name is Joan Hamburg. It's she does a show. It's kind of like it's a New York show. If you're looking, if you come to town and you're looking for a restaurant, or you're looking for where to go for the theater, or you're looking for bargain tickets, you call Joan. She knows all this information, and she was going to christen the boat. Well, they gave her a nice champagne bottle. They wrapped it in a towel, the whole bit. And we had like three or four mics up at the bow of the boat. She's going to do this thing. We park in front of the Statue of Liberty. I mean, you turn around. You're looking in Lady Liberty's face. And she goes out, and they got a whole bunch, as many people as we could cram into the bow. And she's got this thing, and she winds up like Derek Jeter, and she takes a swing. And three, two, one, thunk. The bottle didn't break.
Oh.
All we got was thunk, a pregnant pause, and the crowd burst into laughter.
Of course.
But that was fun. That was a lot of fun. It was a really fun morning. You know, it was a summer.
Did she try again, or did she stop right there?
She tried it again. This time she smashed it.
Okay.
But we went all the way down to the Statue of Liberty. We came all the way back, and we finished the show in dock. I think it was only the last half hour of the show was in dock. I mean, we started the show in dock, and about 10 minutes later, we were on the river. So yeah. It worked out really well. And for communication back to the station, we used cell phones because, let's face it, on the Hudson River, you got New York on one side, Jersey on the other. How many cell sites would you like?
Yeah.
And it worked like a champ. It really worked like a champ. I was surprised when we did the test. I sat there and said, this is never going to work. But I was able to keep it on the bird, and that's what counted.
That's a good story. And good. You think about where's the connection you're going to come from? And you thought about, the sky above. We can see that on our whole trip and use the Inmarsat. And, other stations have done that, too, using various different brands of ISDN codecs. I know there's some people that are using Telos, Zephyrs, and Extremes to do remote broadcasts over satellite provided ISDN. That's pretty cool. Hey, Chris Tarr, I know you there in Milwaukee. You got to do a bunch of remotes. You've probably had some crazy goofy ones. Why don't you tell us about?
Unlike the guys in New York City, when we out do the cow tipping contests out here in the back 40, and the beer drinking contest.
What about the cow tipping contest?
The cow tipping stuff's great. Of course, the cow chip tossing and that sort of thing. We're really lucky here where ISDN is plentiful and easy to get and cheap. So really, most of the time when we need something really high quality, we'll go with ISDN. Although I do have to mention that as we were talking about remote gear, one of my favorite pieces of remote gear you can't use anymore, but I loved it. It was so great. I had an old analog bag phone, cellular phone with just a regular old Comrex frequency extender. I'll tell you what.
Oh yeah,
that thing was awesome. You could take it anywhere. You got signal all over the place. And with the frequency extender, it actually sounded pretty good. And I'll tell you what, that way it was easy to carry, easy to use. You just plug in a microphone, grab an RE20, plug it into the Comrex frequency extender, dial the sucker in, and you're good to go. So I do love that a lot. But in terms of today, really, we're just now starting to get into some of the IP stuff for audio, but we've been spoiled just now. The Wisconsin State Fair happening next week. It was a 10-minute call to get an ISDN line ordered and ready for our slot over at the State Fairgrounds for one of our stations. So we really haven't gotten to the point where we've had to try anything new yet because, just call and get an ISDN line put in, no problem.
Wow, so your phone company hasn't fired the ISDN people.
No, although I'll tell you, it is when we have POTS lines issues, it's hard to get somebody who knows those POTS lines. But with ISDN, so far, and I've asked them, and so far they have no plans to discontinue. In fact, I have one as an emergency. I have an emergency ISDN line at our transmitter site, which actually stopped working and had a guy out today. 10 minutes later, he got it fixed. So, they still actively sell it and repair it.
Wow. Well, that's good to know. In New York City, Tom, Chris, ISDN, hard to get, difficult to get? What's the story?
You can still get it, but we were told, and of course, our facility at the 111 Broadway, I've got, I think I have 40 ISDN lines in the facility. All of our call-in lines are ISDN.
Yeah.
We were told that when they come in to modernize a central office, it's going to be strictly IP. And ISDN will go away. We will have 90 days to figure out what to do.
Wow.
But they haven't come up with a timetable, so we have no idea when they're going to start or when they're even going to consider this. With the economy the way it is, I don't think it's going to be anytime soon, but you never know.
I want to point out an important differentiation in IP between a dedicated type of IP service and a shared IP service. There's a lot of people, some engineers, for example, have tried various different IP codecs, and they try connecting it to their business network, and then they try to do a remote broadcast to the outside world. And sometimes it's not so successful. Why?
Especially when somebody's playing fantasy baseball.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Or too many of the salespeople are playing Farmville. Why? Because you're sharing this bandwidth. And now there's things you can do in the router to perhaps give some priority to those packets that you want to go, the audio packets. Not always successful. Or a lot of engineers don't know how to set that up in the router. My point is this. If you get ISDN, you have a copper pair that is going to carry a framed 128 kilobit per second of B channel audio, two B channels, and then a D channel, a data channel. I think it's 9.6 kilobits per second. So you've got this data rate and nothing else is sharing that connection. Well, if you get a DSL or cable drop IP somewhere and you only use it for your IP codec, sure, there could be bandwidth issues back in the infrastructure from your provider, whether it's AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, whoever it may be, but probably not. They have a lot of infrastructure there. Most of the time, the bandwidth restrictions come at the local end, at your office, at your radio station, at your home. So my point is this. If you're thinking that IP telephony or other IP services are like having, say, Vonage at your house or Magic Jack, where you're sharing this bandwidth with lots of other devices. It's not necessarily like that. If you are getting IP service from a company that has the copper, like, for example, AT&T in many areas, or the company I work for, Telos, we have an office in Riga, Latvia, and they've converted to all IP. Well, when they have a drop of copper into your office that contains your SIP trunks, your phone lines in IP format, that's all that's on there. Is the phone calls. And my point is that you're not sharing that link, that bandwidth with anybody. That's there for your phone calls. And so IP can be extraordinarily reliable, just like ISDN, as long as you're using it correctly. Go ahead.
Well, you know, you're right, but I want to qualify that because we're using public IP to stream audio from one location to another every day. Our night show is received here via satellite and streamed to our Madison facility over the public internet. Yep. And we have absolutely no problem. We have, in the year and a half that we've been doing it, I can count the number of times on one finger that we've had a major outage. Now, we do have, dedicated T1s to the public internet in each side. Uh-huh. But I think, one of the biggest keys is we did have some jittery and some issues at first. But I think, part of the thing is these codecs have become more and more efficient over the years. And, I think originally dedicated IP was an absolute requirement if you're going to pull this kind of stuff off. But look at now. I mean, every week we sit here on Skype and do our thing with video and audio, and very rarely do we have a hiccup. So I think as codecs get better and as engineers we start using codecs more efficiently, I think the public versus private IP is going to kind of blur a little bit, because again, first thing most people do when they set up these codecs is turn it for max quality, when half that bit rate you'll probably get the same quality or close to the same quality, at least something sufficient for what you're needing to do. So I think some of that will balance itself out in the end between the public and private networks.
Yeah. Yeah,
I would absolutely agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same here.
I'm sorry, Chris Tobin, go ahead.
I would agree with Chris on that, because we have two of our sports guys on a cable modem, public internet, doing sports reports every weekend, three times an hour for the last 9 months, and we haven't had one incident.
Yeah, yeah. I do think it's getting better. I'm just thinking of an experience I had a few weeks ago when I went to Riga, Latvia, to the company I work for, Telos. Went to the office there in Riga, and we had a dealer seminar. We brought in dealers from all over Europe and did a seminar there, and we did some Skype video back to the U.S. We talked to Frank Foti and Corny Gould over Skype, and then we also did an interview with one of the developers of our public internet that IP codec, the Zephyr IP, fellow named Tony Timmott. In fact, he's been on this show before, the show we did from NAB. I kid him, told him he was the inventor of the internet. I mean, of MP3. And so we did this interview with Tony over the hotel's internet connection, and it was perfect, absolutely rock solid perfect. We talked to him for almost an hour. And never a hiccup, never a glitch. And I was really surprised that the hotel had internet service that was unburdened enough to where this worked and worked quite well with, I think we had exactly one packet of buffering in each direction. And he was in, by the way, he was in Freising, Germany, outside of Munich. And we were in Riga, Latvia, and the connection was just absolutely rock solid. So I'm encouraged that the internet infrastructure is going this direction. I'm sure there's challenges. There'll be good times and bad times, but overall, I think it's getting better and better. We're going to have to wrap this up in a couple of minutes, but Tom, you had something to tell us, a commuting story from last Monday. What was that you had for us?
No, it was actually 2 days ago, this past Monday.
Yeah.
I'm cruising along. I'm coming down Route 17 in New Jersey, and I come to a traffic light in Hasbrook Heights. And, it's Monday morning. It's after the weekend. I'm half in the bag, and I'm looking across the intersection going, ooh, Starbucks. So this storm, as I'm doing this, is moving through. We had some quick-moving storms come through. They were rather intense. And I'm watching the clouds light up, kind of in the distance. And all of a sudden, on the other side of Route 17, maybe 60 feet from the car, lightning bolt comes down, sustained, and hits a utility pole, lasts about 7 or 8 seconds, and vaporized the top line.
Oh, my.
And I said, that's a heck of a way to wake up on Monday morning. That was
What was this? Do you remember, was it the sky shield line? Was it the ground line, or was it one of the?
I think it was the ground line, but it wasn't there when the lightning bolt went away. Let me tell you.
That's why lightning never hits the same place twice. It's not the same after lightning.
Stuff's not there anymore.
Wow. Hey, guys, this has been a lot of fun. Appreciate your participation. Chris Tarr, thanks for making the extra effort to join in from your radio station. Appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
And tell us about where people can find you and can talk more radio engineering.
Well, the best place to get to all of that is to just stop by my landing page here at thegeekjedi.com.
TheGeekJedi.com. You have a forum there for people to rant and rave and...
Yeah, there's a link to our broadcast engineering forum, which is broadcastengineering.info.
Uh-huh.
You can... great forum there for everybody.
All right. Thanks for being with us. Also, the other Chris Tobin from Manhattan. Thanks for being with us, Chris.
Oh, you're welcome. Anytime.
Appreciate your story too. That was really interesting about the IP radio and how well that worked out from the boat. And the other guy with a boat, Tom Ray, thanks for telling us about that.
Hey, not a problem. That was an enjoyable remote, and of course, this is always an enjoyable time.
Hey, thanks for getting everybody for joining us. You can see at the show notes, and you can subscribe to the show and download. You can get the RSS feed, read the show notes, and look at all that at our website, which is thisweekinradiotech.com. I know it's a long name, but it's all spelled out, thisweekinradiotech.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast, the audio podcast, in the iTunes store. Just go to the iTunes store, do a little search for TWIRT, T-W-I-R-T. You'll find a couple of them there. Ours is pretty obvious. And subscribe with that, it there. It's free, and if you do that, you'll have it downloaded automatically from right there. And you're welcome to participate in our forums or leave a comment about a show note and tell us what you'd like to hear about. If there's somebody in the broadcasting industry or technical field that you'd like us to interview, let us know who that is, and we will try to get that person on. We're here every Wednesday evening live on the Twit Network at live.twit.tv. Today, we were an hour later than usual to make room for some other shows, and next week, we're back at our usual time, which is 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 Central, and 5 p.m. Pacific Time. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you'll see us again next week at This Week in Radio Tech.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another twirt has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you liked today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here.
Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LaPay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.